from the city of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art. Located in the southeast lot of Lincoln Square Mall, downtown Urbana. Information is available at 384-2444.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by a grant from International Galleries in Urbana's Lincoln Square Mall, offering functional stoneware, hand-carved boxes, meditation statuary, candles, and incense. International Galleries also offers custom framing services for your fine art print, photos, needlework, and fabric art. Rush service is always available.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Henry Frain is at the controls. Tomorrow morning in the first hour of the program, we'll be talking about North Korea, about how the country sees itself, about particularly its relationship with Japan, and of course, concerns about its developing nuclear weapons. Our guest for this program will be Gavin McCormick. He is professor of Asian history at the Australian National University in Canberra. He'll be talking with us about his recent book titled Target North Korea, Pushing North Korea to the Brink of Nuclear Catastrophe. That's hour one. Hour two, an opportunity to talk with your congressional representative, at least some of your representative. Our guest will be Tim Johnson. He's a Republican member of Congress from the 15th Congressional District, a lot of our listening area in the 15th. So it's your opportunity to have some direct access to your representative and ask him whatever questions you like. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus 580, we will be exploring the life of a man who many would consider to be one of the most overlooked, perhaps the most overlooked, of all of the founding fathers. And also, considering everything that he did and achieved during his lifetime, perhaps one of the greatest Americans never to have served as the President of the United States. The man we're talking about here is Alexander Hamilton. He was born in the West Indies, and he came to New York just as a teenager from rather disadvantaged circumstances. But he rose quickly. At 22, he acted essentially as chief of staff to George Washington during the American Revolution. At 32, he was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. At 34, he founded the Treasury Department and died when he was only 49, killed in a duel with Aaron Burr. That's perhaps one of the few things that most Americans could tell you about Alexander Hamilton, other than perhaps that he was the first Secretary of the Treasury. This morning, in this part of the program, we'll be talking with the author of a new biography, which is titled Alexander Hamilton. Our guest is Ron Chernow. He is the author of several other biographies and has won a number of awards for his work. His first book, The House of Morgan, won the National Book Award in 1990. His other books include The Warburgs. He has authored a biography of John D. Rockefeller entitled Titan. It was a bestseller and a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. His new book, Alexander Hamilton, is published by the Penguin Press. You should certainly be able to find it in the bookstore now if you want to read it. And questions here are welcome. All we ask of people who call in is just that they're brief, so that we can keep the program moving. But, of course, anyone who is interested in calling can do that. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Chernow, hello.
Pleasure to be here with you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I think that when you look at what Alexander Hamilton managed to achieve in his life, his contributions to America, certainly significant in and of themselves. I guess, though, that I think, to me, it looms even larger when you look at the circumstances of his birth and his childhood, the fact that when he was young, his father left the family. Not long after that, his mother died. He didn't have other relatives to turn to. He was extremely disadvantaged when he started out. And when you look at what it is he managed to achieve, to me, that makes it even more.
You're right. I mean, this was a nightmarish Dickensian childhood. As you pointed out, his father abandons the family when he's 11. His mother dies suddenly when he's 13. And then, in fact, he's farmed out to this first cousin who commits suicide a year later. And then he's toiling away at this trading firm on St. Croix in the Caribbean, today part of the U.S. Virgin Islands. And so the idea that this illegitimate, orphaned kid would end up as one of the founding fathers of the United States is a tale that if I were a novelist and had invented this, people would find it incredible.
So obviously he was both very bright and also, you can see from the course that his life took, that he was a very ambitious man. As a young man he was, and that was something that continued to, ambition continued to drive him. It may in fact have been his undoing ultimately.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, he lacked what in the 18th century they called birth, breeding, certainly money. Just the story of how he escaped from the Caribbean, I think, tells a lot, because this was an orphan who had to live by his wits, and there was a monster, Hurricane Les St. Croix, and he sat down and he wrote a description of such precocious force and eloquence that the local merchants banded together to finance his education in North America, which is how he ends up going, you know, as an adolescent from the Caribbean to New York, and he studies at King's College, what was later renamed Columbia, and already as an undergraduate, because he becomes an undergraduate around the time of the Boston Tea Party, he's delivering spellbinding speeches to large crowds, he's writing these blazing polemical pamphlets against the British, he even picks up a musket and he's drilling with his fellow students in nearby churchyard. So one of the wonderful things about writing this story, one of the extraordinary things about the man, is that he's a great thinker and doer. He's not only one of the great intellectuals in American history, but as we see during the Revolution, he's actually something of a daredevil.
As you mentioned, he managed to get enough support so that he could go to New York to go to university. And I guess before that also went to a prep school.
Went to prep school in Elizabeth, New Jersey.
In New Jersey. Before that, do we know much about whether what he had in the way of formal schooling?
You know, very little, because Hamilton had such a horrifying childhood that he essentially shut the door on the past. Once he came to North America, he never revisited the Caribbean. He scarcely ever even referred to it. One of the very, very few references he ever made, he said his earliest memory was of standing on a table. He was born in the British island of Nevis, and he remembered standing on a table on Nevis reciting the Ten Commandments in Hebrew to a Jewish woman. Now, this sounds like a very bizarre,
sounds apocryphal to me.
What it was that the island of Nevis, about a quarter of the island, was Sephardic Jews, and there was a school, and so he probably had some tutoring from an elderly woman, which is often the way that education occurred in the Caribbean. We know that he then spends his adolescence on St. Croix, and towards the very end of his stay there, there's a Presbyterian minister named Hugh Knox who recognizes this wunderkind in their midst, and Hugh Knox opens his library to young Alexander. But there doesn't seem to be much evidence of formal schooling. He seems to be one of the great autodidacts in American history.
Mm. And he certainly seemed to have a great skill at speaking off the cuff. He did marvelously well. He also wrote, during his lifetime, wrote a stunning amount of material.
Absolutely stunning amount. In fact, the most recent edition of his collected papers runs to 22,000 pages. It was published by Columbia University Press, and evidently the chief editor of the papers used to joke that he intended to dedicate these 27 volumes to Aaron Burr, quote, without whose cooperation this project would never have been completed. I mean, Hamilton was a human word machine, and I say in the book, I think that he probably wrote the theoretical maximum number of words that a human being can write in 49 years.
Hmm. You know, what's important to, or at least it seems very important when you think about his background and think about how he is often perceived as being the polar opposite of Jefferson, and that Jefferson is styled to be the man of the people. His ideal American was the yeoman farmer. He believed in a decentralized government, all that sort of stuff. And that Hamilton himself is often represented as being, if not an aristocrat, someone who was an elitist and who identified with aristocracy. And that when you look at it, it seems odd, really, that you would see him that way, considering the fact that he was
self-made man.
He was the ideal self-made man. Yeah. He was an ardent abolitionist, and so you have to perhaps reassess who he really was and consider how, after he was dead, people who had been his political enemies shaped the way that he was seen.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the great ironies of this period is that Thomas Jefferson, who's always represented as the tribune of the common people, you know, owns 200 slaves, and Hamilton, who was always derided as the pseudo-aristocrat, was a passionate abolitionist throughout his life. In fact, even during the American Revolution, he and his friend John Lawrence championed a plan to emancipate any slave who's willing to pick up a musket for the Continental Army. As soon as the Revolution is over, Hamilton co-founds the first abolitionist society in New York. He also, when he's Treasury Secretary, he lends his name and prestige to what later became Hamilton College. It was originally designed to educate Native Americans. He said very sympathetic and enlightened things about Jews. This turns out to be a man who is devoid of prejudice. There was elitism. You know, one of the differences between Hamilton and Jefferson was that Jefferson, at least on paper, professed to have much more faith in the wisdom of the common people. Hamilton felt that the electorate was more likely to be swept by popular and dangerous passions, you know, to be manipulated by demagogic leaders. And so he felt very strongly that politicians should be educated, well-informed people who responded to their own sense of principle rather than simply, you know, reflecting the popular will. You know, so there's some grain of truth to the stereotype, but I try in the book to point out that this period is often presented as a kind of, you know, morality play where Jefferson is the good guy combating the evil Hamilton, and the story was much, much more complicated than that.
Well, and there's another thing obviously at work here, the fact that Hamilton died relatively young. He was only 49 when he was killed in this duel, so he wasn't around to speak for himself or defend himself after that. And to what extent do you think our perceptions of Hamilton now, or people's perceptions of Hamilton in the past, had been shaped by Jefferson or others who indeed were his political opponents when he was alive?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good point, because Alexander Hamilton had a very, very unusual knack for making friends, and he had an equally unusual knack for making enemies. And the enemies he made tended to be very powerful enemies. I mean, so his main enemies are John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe. Well, I've just named presidents 2, 3, 4, and 5, and particularly Adams and Jefferson both outlive Hamilton by 22 years. They conduct the grandest correspondence in American political history. It's fascinating for anyone who's never read that correspondence. And there are moments in that correspondence where the one big thing that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams seem to have in common is their hatred of Alexander Hamilton. And not only did Hamilton not have a chance to respond to that, because I'm sure Hamilton's memoirs would have been voluminous, 5 years before Hamilton died, George Washington, who was his great patron, died. So Washington dies without having written his memoirs. And so, you know, history is not only written by the victors, history is written by the long-lived.
Mm. Let me introduce again, for people who might have tuned in, our guest for this part of Focus. We're talking with Ron Chernow. He is the author of a new biography of Alexander Hamilton, and that's the title of the book. It's published by the Penguin Press. It's just out, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Another one of those questions that I'm sure comes up a lot is that, given everything that Hamilton did and the role that he played in forming the American government in its early stages, how is it that Alexander Hamilton, not only was he never president, he apparently never even sought the presidency?
Yeah, he never received a single electoral vote. The highest that he rose was the first Treasury Secretary. But I should point out that when he was the first Treasury Secretary, the Treasury Department was much larger than the rest of the government combined. So when you tell someone he was the first Treasury Secretary, doesn't sound all that impressive. But in fact, his role in Washington's administration was much more akin to that of a prime minister, let's say, than to a mere treasury secretary, because about 90% of the government employees are in the Treasury Department. Of course, he has to create that from scratch. Just to answer your question, I think that there was a kind of hierarchy among the revolutionary leaders in terms of age. Washington was 23 years older than Hamilton. He became the first president. Adams was about 20 years older. He became the second. Jefferson was the third president. I think he was about 13 years older than Alexander Hamilton. So it's partly that Hamilton is cut down young before his turn in the rotation has come. But I also argue in the book that Alexander Hamilton, I think possibly the greatest policymaker in American history, was not the greatest politician. In fact, he was often an awful politician because he was so candid, he was so outspoken and opinionated and uncompromising in his opinions, that, you know, the great politicians tend to be much more guarded in their statements, much more hopeful in their statements. And Alexander Hamilton, you know, thought that it was demagogic to constantly flatter the American people and tell them how wonderful they were and how wonderful the country was. And, of course, these are the things our great politicians have almost instinctively understood that that's the way to the voters' hearts.
And there is another thing that you also write about in the book, and that he had in his past a sex scandal, and the suspicion was that if he would indeed run for president or put himself forward as a candidate for president, that would come out and cause great embarrassment, to hurt to his family, and probably scuttle the effort.
Yeah, no, because no one, to my knowledge, in previous biographies had made this point. Hamilton, for an entire year when he was Treasury Secretary, was having an adulterous affair with young Mrs. Reynolds, and then Mr. Reynolds began to blackmail Hamilton. Hamilton's enemies, the Jeffersonians, get wind of this affair. And there's like a five-year period where they know about the affair but don't go public with it. During those 5 years, Hamilton is aware and is made aware that if he ever were to run for president, that this sexual scandal would be revealed and would do damage not only to his career but quite obviously to his wife and his many children. And so I think that this is an unspoken reason or an overlooked reason why Hamilton never became president. Hmm.
And this was, it was not a case where he had the affair, husband finds out, then the blackmail started. This it appears to have been a deliberate setup to create a situation where he could be blackmailed?
Yeah, I think so. Well, what happens, just briefly to tell the story, the government was then in Philadelphia. One day, 23-year-old Maria Reynolds comes to Hamilton's door, asks to speak to him privately. She spills out this woeful tale, how she's been abandoned by her husband, and could Hamilton provide financial aid? And Hamilton later wrote that when he went around to Mrs. Reynolds' rooming house that night with a banknote for her, he found her at the top of the stairs. She invited him into her bedroom, and then he memorably wrote and said, once we were in the bedroom, it became clear that other than pecuniary consolation would be acceptable. So Hamilton imagines that he's rescuing this damsel in distress, but in fact, Mr. and Mrs. Reynolds seem to have been a pair of confidence tricksters, because suddenly Mr. Reynolds surfaces from the blue, and instead of putting an end to the adulterous affair, he begins to charge Hamilton for it. And Hamilton, amazingly enough, Treasury Secretary, most powerful man in the government, begins to pay blackmail money to Mr. Reynolds, and he doesn't seem to have the willpower to break off this affair until it's gone on for a year. It shows you, we've seen other cases of this among politicians, that some of the smartest politicians can do some of the most foolish things imaginable.
Hmm. Well, stepping back a little bit, we talked earlier about his childhood, about the fact that he went to first to prep school in New Jersey, and then he went to King's College, which later became Columbia University in New York. And his studies were interrupted by the Revolution, and he left King's College. He never did get a degree there, and he became a commander of an artillery company in New York. What did he have any sort of previous military experience before that?
No, this, you know, he started voraciously reading different books on military history and gunnery. He seemed to be one of these people who could teach himself to master almost anything. In fact, one of the most touching things about his story is that during the Revolution, he's effectively Washington's chief of staff for 4 years during the Revolution, and from camp to camp, he's lugging these tremendous folio-sized volumes called the Dictionary of Trade and Commerce. And we see in the empty pages of a military paybook, he's recording notes on population growth, foreign exchange, geography, European rivers. You see himself at night, even during the American Revolution, he's giving himself a crash course in history, finance, and politics. And it looks like he's already, at this early stage, grooming himself to be Treasury Secretary later on. It's quite incredible the way he can teach himself things.
So how does he come to the attention of George Washington?
Well, you know, one of the characteristics of Hamilton, he had the orphan's knack for impressing influential people from the moment that he steps off the boat in North America. And there are various Revolutionary War generals, including Henry Knox and William Alexander, Nathaniel Greene, and then finally Washington himself, Battle of White Plains, and during the subsequent retreat across New Jersey, sees Hamilton in action with his artillery company and is very, very impressed by this young man and his discipline and his professionalism in with his company. And Hamilton was a rather slight frame. He was about 5'6", rather slight build, and yet he's extremely courageous on the battlefield, and he instills this crisp discipline into his men. So it seems like all of the generals notice him. In fact, one thing about Alexander Hamilton throughout his life, it seems as if anyone who spent even 5 minutes in his company recognized that he was someone of exceptional intelligence and ability.
Perhaps you could talk a little bit more about the relationship between Hamilton and Washington. And I know sometimes it seems to have been described as something of a almost a relationship of father and son, and I think that maybe you argue that that's really not the right way to look at
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you know, for me it kind of captures the chemistry of what went on. You know, since Washington was 23 years older and 7 inches tall, it's kind of natural to think in terms of a father-son relationship. But in fact, Hamilton was a very, very headstrong young man, and I think that he did not find it easy to be the number two to anyone, even George Washington. I think that of the various young men on Washington's staff, Hamilton was probably the only one who could easily imagine himself running the army. But it becomes, even though it doesn't have the warmth of a father-son relationship, it's a little bit more business-like. There's tremendous mutual respect more than mutual affection. But these are two men of very complementary talents, because Washington has this extraordinary patriotism, integrity, and great judgment. And great judgment was not something that Hamilton always had. Hamilton has the policy brilliance and the flair and the stamina, and so Washington needs a great policy making mind. Hamilton, in turn, needs political cover. And also, Hamilton is a very volatile personality. He needs the guiding hands and steady judgment of George Washington. And so Hamilton does actually his best work when he's in harness to George Washington, when Hamilton is on his own and just following his own judgments. His own judgment was very, very fallible.
We have a caller here, someone on the cell phone, to bring into the conversation, so we will do that. We'll not make them wait on our line number 4. Hello. Is a caller there?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, this is Bob in Bloomington.
Sure.
I'm in my car, so I'm going to ask 2 questions and hang up and then listen.
Okay.
One, I'd like to know, other people, of course, have written about Hamilton. Can you situate your work in relation to them and what contribution you make that they don't? And second, your books are all about very powerful and wealthy people, and I'd like to know what has drawn you to your topics. Thanks a lot, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Right. Well, in terms of, you know, what I added, one of the reasons that I did this book is that between 1961 and 1987, there was a brand new edition of Hamilton's collected papers published by Columbia University Press. It almost quadrupled or quintupled the amount of information we had of Hamilton. They're extraordinary editions, not only everything written by and to Hamilton, but they scoured the world, every diary entry, every newspaper reference. So I had phenomenal materials to work with. I supplemented it with a lot of original research, not only in this country, but in 8 Caribbean archives, in Denmark and Scotland and in England. So I think, or I like to think, that I cast the net much wider than before. And there had not been a kind of big cradle-to-grave, go-for-broke, full-length book on Hamilton since the 1960s, although there had been some very good short bios about one aspect or another of Hamilton's life. And the second question now was, can you refresh?
Well, he was remarking on the kinds of other subjects that you've written on, yeah. and what is it that ties them together, if anything?
Yeah, it's kind of less. Some people imagine them as sort of just fascinated by rich men, which is not what has drawn me to these books. What I felt was that economic history had been overlooked, that economics and finance was kind of the unseen dimension of history. And so what I tried to do in these books is I see them as mainstream history, where I'm blending not only political and social history, but also the kind of economic and financial history that often forms the secret backdrop of mainstream history, but which I felt had not been sufficiently emphasized. And then in order to make the books as palatable and entertaining as possible, they've also been in the form of biographical narratives and family sagas, because I've learned as a historian that if I can engage people in human dramas, it's amazing how much information they can absorb if given that information just in dull Latin abstract form. They'll shut the book after 10 pages, so that the story is what lures them in, and once you have them lured into the story, people are only too happy to get a good history lesson.
In what ways is the American economy what it is today as a result of Hamilton? And maybe that's an awkward way of asking the question, but you know what it is I'm asking.
Yeah, no. Well, there's a public side and a private side. On the private side, at the same time that Jefferson's vision was of a nation of yeoman farmers, and that we would, remain this kind of agrarian Eden, if we ever were. Of course, a lot of the reality was slaveholding plantations in the South rather than small yeoman farmers. But Hamilton has a competing vision, and he has a vision of a nation that would have traditional agriculture. He realized that would be important for a very long time. But he also foresaw a nation that would have banks and stock exchanges, corporations and factories, at a time when this was considered very scary futuristic stuff. And he actively helped to establish these things, not only established the first central bank, the forerunner of the Federal Reserve Board when he was Treasury Secretary, but he co-founds the Bank of New York, still the 11th largest bank in the country, oldest stock traded on the New York Stock Exchange. He co-founds this futuristic industrial city that's now Paterson, New Jersey. In terms of the government itself, well, as Treasury Secretary, just to rattle off the list, he creates the first Customs Service, first Coast Guard, first tax system, first budget system, government accounting systems, first central bank. And most important of all, he's making the enduring constitutional arguments that these are permissible activities for the federal government. And so he's actually creating the fiscal and monetary system of the federal government, while at the same time he's, I think, tremendously enlarging the range of possibility in the private economy.
Our telephone number here, if you'd like to call in and join the conversation, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Again, our guest is Ron Chernow, author of a new biography of Alexander Hamilton. I suppose one of the reasons that perhaps some people found to dislike him was that they saw him as a climber, a social climber, and he certainly, you certainly can see him that way. And I guess that one of the things that you would look at would be his marriage, his interest to find someone who was from a wealthy and important family, and he certainly found that in Elizabeth Schuyler, whose father was a general and one of the leading families of New York. Was that, in addition to being an advantageous match, was that also a love match?
Oh, I think it was. You know, let me just say, I think that Hamilton was a climber. On the other hand, remember, he was an illegitimate, you know, orphaned, impoverished kid from the Caribbean. And I think that, our other founders, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, grew up on these, vast slave plantations in Virginia. I think that Hamilton's upward mobility is something that should be celebrated, what he did with his life. Hamilton admitted that he needed to marry into money. Because Hamilton was involved in the sexual scandal that I was talking about before, people have imagined that he was unhappily married just because he was involved in the sex scandal. One of the things that I hope I show in the book, one thing I hope that I've contributed that's knew about Hamilton, I think it was an extraordinarily happy marriage. They had 8 children. In fact, I showed that Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton, his wife, outlives him by 50 years. Like, I opened the book with the scene of Eliza Hamilton, who lived almost to the Civil War. She died at age 97, November 1854. And she spent a lot of her final years lovingly preserving every scrap that he ever wrote. She was an amazing woman who co-founded and for nearly 3 decades ran the first orphanage in New York. And it's clear from all of the letters that I quote from her during her widowhood that she absolutely adored him. And we have all of his letters to her, and I must say they're affectionate, they're tender. There is not a single unkind word over the approximate 24, 25-year period of their marriage.
And her letters to him, she destroyed. So
yeah,
that side of the conversation we don't have.
Yeah, in fact, she was a very religious woman. She was very self-effacing. She thought he was the important one. She also thought that she felt that he belonged to history, so that his papers should be preserved. She didn't feel that she should be part of the historical record, so she consigned herself to obscurity. So in the book, she tried to put herself in the shadows, and I keep trying to drag her out of the shadows because I think that she was a remarkable woman, and I think that her own personal humility should not allow her to be forgotten.
Well, that's another interesting, I think, significant point about the Hamiltons, and given the fact that she was who she was, that she had been married to Alexander Hamilton, that she lived for such a long time afterward, she, of all of the wives of the founding fathers, she is also, seems to be much less known. Her profile is not anything like Martha Washington or John Adams' wife, or Mrs. Madison, or any of those women.
Yeah, no, there's no question. I mean, Abigail Adams was an absolutely brilliant, devastatingly sharp, funny, perceptive writer. And of course, Martha Washington's life was much more public. Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton is much more private. She's much more domestic. She's not a great beauty. She's not a great intellectual. What I tried to show in the book is there. She was a woman. She was a woman of great charm and attractiveness, but she was a woman, I think, of extraordinary integrity. And I hope that as people read this book and kind of understand what a volatile, intense character Hamilton was, if he did not have this loving, steadying influence in his life, I don't see how he could have done. Of course, he was also very, very forgiving because this was a man who strayed, and because he had strayed, it was thought that he was not appreciative of his wife. I think that he most emphatically was. So it's kind of a quieter set of virtues, but for me, no less moving. And of course, when he dies, she's left. Hamilton dies insolvent. She's left with seven children between the ages of 2 and 20. Brings them all up. Almost all of them do very interesting and significant things. And so, it's an amazing story of human endurance as well. So I thought that since she didn't want to call attention to herself, that I would call a little attention to her.
We have some callers to talk with. Let's do that. We'll start first with someone in Chicago, line 4.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Just a momentary diversion from the main body of the broadcast. For those who may have an interest, Hamilton's buried in the churchyard cemetery of St. Paul's Chapel, which is at the corner of Broadway and Fulton Street in New York. It's a block from Ground Zero, and it's part of the Trinity Church complex. Trinity Church itself is just a few blocks away from there. It's where Washington went to church at, during his stay in New York City when he was first inaugurated president.
Yeah, you're
across,
right.
Across the street from the old AT&T and Western Electric buildings.
Hamilton is actually buried in the Trinity Churchyard, a few blocks to the south. But you're absolutely right that after Washington's inauguration, they walk up Broadway, they pray at St. Paul's Chapel, which you're absolutely right, is across the street from Ground Zero. And in fact, when Hamilton was an undergraduate at King's, now Columbia at that point, it was located on the Hudson River downtown. And so Hamilton, when with his student group, they used to drill in the churchyard at St. Paul's, which is literally across the street from Ground Zero. It's kind of poignant. In fact, I live in Brooklyn Heights, just across the East River from Manhattan, so not far from Ground Zero. And I'll never forget when they finally, after 9/11, opened up that area. I'll never forget seeing Hamilton and Eliza's grave covered with the white ash from the World Trade Center.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
There used to be a plaque on the fence surrounding the churchyard which stated that Hamilton was buried there. So this goes back years ago. Now, the chapel is just across the street from the old AT&T main offices and Western Electric main offices, which is another point of interest for mm-hmm. those who might be interested.
Sure. Did you have a question or something else?
I just wanted to mention this for anyone who has interest in that.
Okay.
Sort of thing.
Very good. Let's continue. We'll go to Champaign, and this is line 1. Hello.
Yeah. Earlier you were talking about, the guest was talking about Hamilton's many enemies, and it struck me that they really didn't fall on political lines. And could you touch on how these enemies were made, and then also on what his vision for the new country was, because it was quite different than Jefferson's, but he shared some aspects with Adams. And
yeah, let me just kind of broadly characterize the different visions of Jefferson, because Jefferson, as we were saying, foresaw a nation of yeoman farmers. He wanted strong states, a weak central government. He always stressed states' rights, Jefferson, strict construction of the Constitution, tax cuts, limited government. Hamilton saw this much more bustling, diversified economy that in addition to agriculture, there would be factories, trading, commerce, stock exchanges, and the like. Hamilton favored a strong central government, vigorous president, a very broad construction of the Constitution. Now, in terms of Hamilton's enemies, you make an interesting point. Most of his enemies were political enemies. That is, most of them were identified with Jefferson and the Jeffersonian camps, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, even Burr, people in the political opposition. John Adams is kind of an exception, certainly an interesting one, because he and Hamilton are at least nominally co-head of the same party called the Federalist. And in fact, they have quite a lot, there are a lot of differences in their views, but there's also quite a lot of overlap. I mean, for instance, they were both prescient about the French Revolution. They should have been strong comrades in arms, and yet end up having the most bitter dispute. And when Adams is president, he excludes Hamilton from the inner circle, and yet he feels that his cabinet is secretly beholden to and manipulated by Alexander Hamilton. It was a difficult relationship because Adams was a generation older. I mean, Adams is already a towering figure in the Continental Congress, when Alexander Hamilton is literally an undergraduate. They're 20 years apart in age. Washington becomes president. Adams becomes the first vice president. And yet Adams is essentially on the outer edge, the outer edges of the administration, excluded from the policymaking circle. And so Adams, when he's vice president, has to watch, this must have been mortifying, has to watch young Alexander Hamilton, the 34-year-old Treasury Secretary, who was essentially running the government and who has George Washington's ear, so that you could see where this resentment toward Hamilton, this feeling that he was an unworthy young upstart, you know, and who is he to wield all of this power, you could kind of see where the tension between them began.
It has been noted, if you look at, again, going back to Hamilton and Jefferson and their ideas of America, that even though Jefferson is the one who is the more embraced, and particularly I think Republicans like to have him to be their model, that if we brought them both back and showed them what America was, that I don't think Mr. Jefferson would be too happy, or at least Hamilton would look around and say, now this is kind of what I had in mind, and Jefferson would probably say, no, this is not what I had in mind.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, whether you love Hamilton or you hate Hamilton, I think the one thing that's indisputable is that the world we live in is much, much more the world that Alexander Hamilton envisioned, whereas Jefferson's vision seems to be, you know, antique and outmoded at this point. So Hamilton was the prophetic figure. And, of course, because he endorsed a lot of these different economic institutions that would come to play a large role in the future. But things like banks were considered very scary at the time. I mean, Jefferson, Madison, even Adams thought that banks were evil institutions. And so Hamilton, who was in favor of banks, if you're promoting evil institutions, the suggestion naturally rises that you must be evil. So that a lot of the kind of villainization of Hamilton that takes place, to my mind, is inseparable from a lot of the attitudes that were prevalent, particularly in the agrarian South, toward a lot of modern financial and economic institutions that Hamilton is associated with.
Let's talk with someone else. Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello. You're on the track that I was thinking on Hamilton's economic vision for our very new country. And the charge that I keep running into is that he is, among other things, exceedingly elitist, even though he certainly didn't start out that way. Wanted to, didn't seem interested in dispersing the wealth, is the picture I get, and I don't know if that's accurate.
Well, you know, I think that at the time, you know, now the question of whether to, you know, redistribute wealth is in the last century is one that has become part of the political system. But it's not really part of politics at the time because there were no income taxes. So the idea, for instance, of whether to have a progressive tax system or not doesn't arise at all because the country is financed by import duties, and there's a tax on liquor, so that there's no way that the government can redistribute wealth. There wasn't
elitist. Not necessarily through government redistribution, but just to have a wide-ranging economy. Like I said, the picture I get, which may be erroneous, is that he wanted wealth controlled by a limited number of people.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Jefferson, who speaks in this very kind of egalitarian language, the underlying reality is the slaveholding system, which is the most unequal system imaginable. Hamilton, if you read, for instance, his report on manufacturing, he believes in a meritocracy. He believes in a diversified economy where there will be a very, very wide variety of economic institutions.
Have corrected me. I appreciate that.
Read it, because I know this is kind of distorted in a lot of ways, and also since Hamilton, you know, when Hamilton became Treasury Secretary, the United States was literally a bankrupt country. We were bankrupted by Revolutionary War debt. Hamilton introduces a program in order to pay off the Revolutionary War debt and restore American public credit. There are a lot of different financiers and speculators who, you know, scoop up this depreciated debt and make a large amount of money. And so they were the beneficiaries of the Hamiltonian system. From the point of view of the Jeffersonians, it's kind of look how Hamilton was rewarding the speculators. That was not... That was an incidental side effect of what he was doing. It was not why he was doing it, because he wanted to enrich the speculators. He wanted to restore American public credit. And in fact, when Hamilton becomes the first Treasury Secretary, you know, we're paying like the highest interest rates in the world because we're like this third world deadbeat. By the time Hamilton leaves office 5 years later, the United States is qualifying for interest rates as low as the most creditworthy countries in the world. That's really what Hamilton was interested in. The fact that speculators profited off that appreciation of what had been very depressed government debt didn't bother him as much as it clearly bothered the Jeffersonians, who felt that that was the whole point of the exercise. But I honestly don't think that Hamilton saw it that way, and for him, this was just an unavoidable side effect of restoring public credit.
All right, I thank the caller. Let's go to line three, also in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, you didn't mention that Alexander Hamilton, in his reports as the Secretary of the Treasury on the subject of manufacturers, was the first one to systematically set out the infant industry argument, which talks about protectionism. Mm-hmm. Which is galling to most economic conservatives. And something else, I don't know if you've read Michael Lind.
Mm-hmm.
He, in The Observer in England, he wrote a piece arguing that we currently have a lot of similarities with the fundamentalist Muslims, and he points out that Hamilton wasn't worried about Americans becoming decadent or corrupt. He was more worried about them becoming exceedingly self-righteous. So I just wanted to throw those two things out and see if you had any comments.
Okay, let me just comment quickly about it, because you're right that in the report on manufacturers, Hamilton argues for various forms of protection, although he favored bounties for infant industries rather than tariffs, which would be passed along to consumers. I'm not certain that Hamilton 100 years later, 200 years later, would still have been in favor of protectionism, because he lays out arguments that the United States, since it would be competing in a world of very established nation states, that it needed at that point, as it were, as a developing country, it needed some protection. I don't think that he would have advocated it as the United States became a more developed country. On the second point, one thing that worried Hamilton, Jefferson thought strongly that the United States would beacon to humanity, that the American Revolution, you know, should then be copied around the world. Hamilton obviously wanted democracy to spread around the world, but Hamilton also thought that every democratic revolution would have to be tailored to the particular customs and traditions of the country. He didn't think that kind of, you know, one model fits all. And I think that maybe that's a handy insight at the moment.
We'll see if we can try to get one more caller in. We have just a couple of minutes left. We have someone on cell phone, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Enjoying the program. Since I am on the cell phone, I'll go ahead and answer my two questions. I'll hang up. I was struck with the longevity of Hamilton's widow, and I was just curious of any of his children, how long they lived, if any of them lived into the 1900s. And then with regards to the duel, I was wondering if Hamilton, if he died instantly, what the duel was about, and what was the final outcome with Aaron Burr. And I'll go ahead and hang up. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, to take the second question first, Hamilton was shot on the morning of July 11th, 1804. You can see we're about to have the 200th anniversary of that. He died about 30 hours later in the West Village of Manhattan. The duel, oh, that's a complicated story since we're at the end of the show, Burr read in the newspapers that Hamilton had uttered a despicable opinion about him. Hamilton refused to apologize or retracted. Both of them were competing over the same political turf in New York, so that there was a political dimension to it. The first question was,
He noted as you have how long.
Oh, the longevity.
Because
there were, at the time he died, there were seven surviving children. They all did interesting things. One became an assistant, an acting secretary of state under Andrew Jackson. Two of them became U.S. attorneys in New York. They all had long lives. They didn't live. They lived towards the end of the 19th century. None lived into the. Into the 20th century. So off the top of my head, not aware that any of the children made it to age 97.
All right, as their mother
as
did.
Mom did, yeah.
All right. Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. There's, of course, much, much more in this book, and it might indeed change some of your ideas about Alexander Hamilton. So if you're interested, you could seek it out. The title of the book is simply Alexander Hamilton. It's published by the Penguin Press by our guest Ron Chernow, who is also authors of the books The House of Morgan, The Warburgs, and Titan, which is a biography of John D. Rockefeller. Mr. Chernow, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
The program today is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering a collection of products from more than 30 third world countries, from Vietnamese ceramics and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor. Tomorrow morning on the program, hour number one, we'll talk about North Korea with Gavin McCormick. He is a research professor of Asian history at the Australian National University, an author of the book entitled Target North Korea, Pushing North Korea to the Brink of Nuclear Catastrophe. Then in the second part of the show, your opportunity to talk with Tim Johnson. He is a congressman representing the 15th district here in Illinois. A lot of our listeners in the 15th. So whatever's on your mind, you can call in and talk with him. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your calls. Right now, we hope that you will stay tuned. Coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with Joseph Nye Jr. about